This week in Retronauts, what happens when you press down while playing Kid Icarus? Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish. This is episode 574, talking about the Pitfall series, the series where Pit falls through a platform because you press down. It sucks. But the Pitfall series itself is actually pretty good. And with me here, we have a pair of luminaries. Let's start with the person in the time zone nearest me.
Hi, this is Kevin Bunch. I got nothing for clever introductions.
Amazing. This is what happens.
I fell in a pit of my own making.
This is what happens when we record first thing on a Sunday morning. And also that other voice, that mysterious voice speaking from across the ocean.
Oh, hello. I'm Stuart Jip, and I've got one joke for this episode, and it's that if we have a bad game come up, I'm going to say shitfall. That's it. That's all.
Well, you're going to, I think, have the opportunity to flex that joke at some point. Yeah.
I haven't done any research. I've got no other things at all. It's just that one joke. That's why I'm here.
That's good. You know, sometimes you just need to know your moment and let it shine. Mm-hmm. But no, I think this is going to be a good episode because it's going to be one of the rare opportunities where Stuart and the rest of us kind of bridge. It's a chance for us to share our competencies because Kevin and I know a lot about the early Pitfall games and Stuart knows a lot about the later Pitfall games. And so I think between those two different contingencies, the American and the Brit, we'll have a proper episode. It'll be a banger, as they say, but not like the banger in the British style, which is a sausage. It'll be just like really good. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe British sausages are really good. I've never had one.
They are really good. They are great.
Oh, that's why they call them bangers. Okay.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
They're solid. Yeah. I'll be on board with that.
But this is not about Britain or sausages.
What?
It is about adventuring in South America. And I don't, is it about sausages? Is Pitfall the series in any way about sausages?
I can't think of any instance in which sausages manifest in the Pitfall series.
There are scorpions, which you don't want to mistake for a sausage.
Listeners, write in and let us know if we've forgotten about some sausages.
Right, the special sausage level.
Mm. Well, you know, Pitfall Harry, he's out in these jungles. Maybe he needs some canned sausages to help him get that quick energy to avoid scorpions.
Yeah. How do we know that the vines aren't links of sausages? That we have no way of knowing that. So yeah.
That's true. Green ropey sausages.
You know. I think this episode's going really well so far.
It's phenomenal so far. So yes, Pitfall. Let's start by doing the usual banter. Not that the kind of banter we've been doing, but the kind that's actually on topic.
Yeah.
Where we talk about our first experience, our introduction to the Pitfall series. Kevin, I suspect you have Pitfall connections going back further than Stuart, just because of your relative interest in the parts of the series you're most interested in versus him.
Oh, geez. The first Pitfall game I remember playing was the very first one on the 2600. We had it in our collection when I was a kid, and I remember playing it a lot and not really getting anywhere. Like, I had the basic idea of what you were supposed to do in the game, like run around and collect treasures, but I didn't really understand how you were supposed to do that particularly well. I could usually get as far as one of the screens that you had to jump across the alligators, and that was about it. I did not have the dexterity and spatial understanding to actually navigate those.
Right. Well, you know, you need to understand that you can stand on an alligator, but you can't stand on its mouth. You can only stand on its skull. Yeah. If you stand on its mouth, it'll just swallow you at some point.
I didn't know that at all, and I used to try and get across them all in one go, which you can do, but you have to be, like, perfect.
Right.
That's why I would always die there, because I could only sometimes pull that off.
Yeah, I saw my sister do it, so I knew you could. I just couldn't do it myself.
Isn't that just a reference to, is it Live or Let Die, the James Bond movie where he jumps across a swamp full of alligators in New Orleans, just hop across their heads? And they actually filmed it with real alligators, which was just, like, they did stupid stuff in the 70s and 80s in Hollywood. It was amazing.
You know, I've never seen David Crane confirm that, but it wouldn't shock me given how much he just pulled from other media for these.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious influence on Pitfall is Raiders of the Lost Ark, but yeah. That, of course, you know, has much deeper roots itself in media, and you can check that out, learn more about it by listening to our episode on Raiders of the Lost Ark and its games. Anyway, Stuart, what about you?
Oh, my first experience with Pitfall, I think, was I remember seeing the Mayan Adventure in the one issue of EGM that I had, because it's an American magazine, obviously. We didn't really get it here, and I don't know how I came about getting hold of it. But the Mayan Adventure looked really cool, and I saw that it had the feature of you could unlock the original Pitfall, this little Atari game. And I didn't know what that was. I was just like, oh, that's interesting. Like, you know, this has kind of like a lineage kind of going on. A few years later, I got given this like hand-me-down thing, which was like called TV Boy, and it was from a company called Sistema. I think it was like European or something. And it's like a handheld, but you plug it into the TV, and it just runs what I didn't know at the time were Atari 2600 games, with like their colors are different. I don't know if it's an output problem or if they had hacked them, but one of them was called Forest Walk, and it was just Pitfall. Okay. But pink, like pink Pitfall. So the first time I played Pitfall was on this piece of shit hooky TV Boy thing that outputted it wrong and didn't even call it Pitfall. But I knew it was Pitfall because I'd seen that magazine. I was like, this is Pitfall. Hey, wait a minute. Maybe all these games are different things to what they say they are. So, you know, that's how I was ended up playing things like River Raid and Chopper Command and all these great Activision Atari games, not knowing what their real names were until much later. And then I did eventually get Pitfall for Windows 95 because it was like, it was cheap. That's the only reason. I knew it looked good because I'd seen it in the magazine. So I sort of went from super hacked, crappy version of Pitfall to the Mayan Adventure, which is quite the leap, really, because it's a really brilliant game, in my opinion.
Interesting. That's that's quite a circuitous route.
I was quite drawn to it anyway, because I always liked Indiana Jones, so anything like Indiana Jones, where you could sort of play as Indiana Jones, air quotes, and you know, I liked that, so I was on a track to get into Pitfall anyway.
Nice. So my first memory of Pitfall, because I did not have an Atari 2600 or access to such, I remember, of all places, seeing it in a grocery store. This was, you know, back in the early 80s when people would, like, stores, any store that existed would be like, hey, buy a video game here. You know, you'd go random places and there would be an arcade machine just in the middle of the floor. So, yeah, I was at a grocery store and for some reason they had a 2600 kiosk set up. And I remember seeing it and being fascinated, but not being allowed to play. And yeah, I didn't play Pitfall for decades, actually. So I would occasionally see it or see wisps of it. And I have no particular fondness or memories of the game, but I think it's pretty cool. And I will have to say that I've played it recently on the Atari 2600 core of the Analog NT Mini with an NES controller, and that is the way to play it. Like, not having to use the Atari stick. It's so good. I can just, like, do the stuff that I want to because the controller is much more precise and doesn't have the travel and everything. So I highly recommend, yeah, playing Atari 2600 on good hardware with a really kick-ass joystick.
I think for me, the peak way to play Pitfall is on the Activision Anthology on the PlayStation 2, because you can play it with Tears for Fears and like Twisted Sister in the background and have like a filter over it that looks like fag smoke, so you can pretend like the room is full of, oh god, can I say fag smoke on here? Do we have to cut that?
You're British, it's okay. We understand.
Okay, Jesus, oh Christ, that was horrible moment there. But no, that's the peak way to play it, I think. Input lag, whatever, who cares? You get to listen to muscles, like pulling muscles from a shell, so it's great.
So they actually licensed all that music for the Activision Anthology disc?
They sure did.
It's awesome. I love it.
that's a wild amount of money to sink into something totally superfluous for.
I never thought about that that way before, but you're right. It's kind of crazy that they got like Take On Me and stuff, and it's
Yeah, someone at Activision realized it was no longer the 90s, and they had money, so maybe they should just go ahead and do that.
That's a fantastic compilation in general. I recommend it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Alright, so maybe we should talk a little bit about Activision because, wow, Kevin, you put a lot of notes about Activision in here. So I say, go for it.
Alrighty. Yeah, so Activision got its start in October 1979. It was founded by a few former Atari developers who were considered sort of their best consumer division folks. So that's David Crane, who eventually would write Pitfall, Bob Whitehead and Alan Miller, as well as a marketing executive named Jim Levy, who they had met with over the summer and decided that they could work together with. He was very interested in video games. He saw an opportunity that wasn't really going filled for third-party publishing, basically. Larry Kaplan also intended to join them, but in practice, he didn't come up and join Activision until a few months after everyone else. But he was there, too, from nearly the beginning.
So his stock vested later than everyone's?
Yes. He actually had less than everyone else.
That's what happens when you get cold feet.
Yep. So they were very technically proficient on the 2600 hardware. They wrote, I believe what I read was that there was an internal document that circulated at Atari on the best-selling 2600 games, and they realized between the four of them, 60% of the list was their work. So they were a little miffed that they were basically just getting 30 grand a year for all this, you know, millions in sales that Atari was bringing in. So they went to the boss, that was the CEO, Ray Kassar at the time, and this would have been in 1979. And basically, Alan Miller put together this compensation proposal based on what he knew folks in, you know, publishing for books and for music and that sort of thing were getting. Ray Kassar came from the textile world, did not see game developers as anything different in the than a cog in the machine compared to marketing and sales or, you know, like production lines, that sort of thing. So he basically told them they weren't getting anything. They decided that they were going to quit and start their own company. So that gave you Activision.
And because of his greed, the Atari 2600 market imploded and took down the U.S. console industry with it. That's quite a chain of events. That's quite a lot to put on one man's shoulders. But I feel like it's true, because if Activision's founders hadn't left... I don't know if the third-party structure would have really taken off the way it did. Well, there weren't any third... I mean, maybe eventually, but I don't think it would have had nearly as much traction. You know, Activision showing up with great games by well-established designers, I think really legitimized the concept of buying Atari games that didn't have Atari's name in them.
Mm. Well, you know, I think that's true, but also... I feel like Atari's problems were kind of their own making as well in that era. So, like, I heard it described once that Ray Kassar was the ideal CEO for Atari's growth years because, you know, in 1980, Space Invaders came out and just, like, exploded the home console market in basically single-handedly overnight. And then he was also the worst CEO to have when things took a nosedive because... He was very insistent on staying the course, even after it was clear there were problems. So they still kept shipping way too many cartridges out and weren't actively trying to adjust to the market. So, yeah, he was a man of contrasts.
Indeed.
So, yeah, Activision went off on its own. They announced their first four games, and March the following year. So those were Dragster and Fishing Derby by David Crane, Checkers by Al Miller, and Boxing by Bob Whitehead. Atari sued them 2 months later. They claimed that Activision had stolen a bunch of trade secrets making these VCS games, 2600 games. And added to that, that Dragster was clearly a ripoff of one of their arcade games, which it very blatantly is. If you ever look up the Drag Race Atari arcade game, they're like one-to-one. They did eventually settle out of court December 1981. They haven't really... I don't think they ever discussed the terms of the settlement, other than Activision agreed to become an official licensee for Atari. So they were not only the first console third-party publisher, they were the first licensed third-party publisher. And, you know, by that point in time, Activision had just put out all of these games for the VCS that were, you know, just head and shoulders technically more savvy than anything Atari was putting out themselves. If you look at something like Skiing or Laser Blast or Kaboom, Freeway, they just look so much better than what Atari was doing.
It's interesting that Atari didn't have an injunction against Activision during the lawsuit. I would feel like, you know, if they were accusing them of stealing trade secrets and directly ripping off their software, they would have put a C&D on Activision sales. But did they attempt that? Did the court just not grant it?
So Activision laid a bunch of groundwork to prove that they didn't steal any trade secrets. David Crane had to go out and buy a retail 2600 and actively reverse engineer the hardware and like show his notes, basically. So that really deflated their primary argument against Activision. I never read anything about them trying to get an injunction against Drag Race or Dragster. My impression is that because the legal landscape around video game software was so loosey-goosey at that point in time, that they just didn't get anywhere with any attempts that they made.
So the courts were on Ray Kassar's side and said, oh yeah, these are just industrial products, there's no creativity involved. So that actually bit him in the ass in this case. Oh, Ray, if only you had supported video games as a creative endeavor.
Oh, it just was not something he could recognize. So yeah, Activision, they were huge at the time. They were based on the reporting I found, they were the number two company in North America for video games in 1982. In 82, they opened an East Coast office. They reported that they made $64 million in sales. And a total profit of almost $13 million, which was double what they made the previous year. February 83, you know, this was right after the peak year of video games in the U.S. at the time. They announced that they had brought in $157 million with a profit of almost $20 million. And then after that, the market melted down. They tried pivoting to computers, which sort of worked, but they were just sort of a shadow of their former self. By the end of the decade, they were in really rough straits, and that's when everyone's favorite, Bobby Kotick, came in and took over the company in a hostile takeover.
Thanks, Bobby.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bobby Kotick. Thank you for everything.
Wasn't he just like a trust fund teenager who said, I'm going to buy a video game company, and muscled his way in?
I have no idea. I haven't delved into his biography very much because he's awful. But
It's the American dream in action.
But, you know, he did, you know, save Activision, if you call it saving.
Oh, let's see. Oh, no, he wasn't a teenager by that point. He was nearly 30.
I guess I'm not like an expert, but I guess all I can say about Activision and Atari is, like, when I play Atari compilations of 2600 games, I don't have fun. And when I play Activision compilations, I have lots of fun. So they're basically, they are the 2600 as far as I'm concerned.
There are some fun Atari 2600 games by not Activision.
I'm sure there are. Yes. And maybe one day I'll play one of them.
I'll just have to provide a whole laundry list, I guess.
Yeah, I genuinely would love that. There probably are some that I just can't think of right now. I'm very biased because it was Activision from the start for me. I'm very biased. Reporters crowd around your house, going through your garbage like a pack of hounds, speculating what they might find out. It don't matter.
So that is Activision, but we really need to speak specifically about a single man at Activision, because this was, you know, the days when a single man could make a video game and it could be a huge hit. And yeah, so let's talk about David Crane, the guy what did Pitfall in the first place.
Sure thing. So David Crane was originally from Napanee, Indiana. He went to college at the DeVry Institute of Technology. Basically, he was like a hardware computer nerd in high school. He built his own like little game playing machine. And this sort of is what led it to him getting into DeVry. And once he...
You know, DeVry used... I don't know if they still do, but they used to have television ads constantly about how you should enroll at DeVry and, I guess, do, like, the degree by mail thing. And they never once mentioned the fact that, hey, you too could learn how to program video games and create, you know, a multi-million-selling video game from DeVry. They really missed the boat there.
That does seem like something that they should include in their marketing. Yeah,
like, let's hear about some famous alumni, shall we? So, that's why I didn't enroll at DeVry. They failed to lure me in.
I went to a community college that just happened to be near my house.
I didn't enroll at DeVry because I live in England.
I don't think it matters. That's you know, the magic of of degrees by mail.
I'm also stupid.
Hey, you live so close to Cambridge. Why would you bother?
Yeah, that's a trick. It's just a trick, to be honest. I'm trying to trick people.
Oh, man. So he finished up at DeVry, and he managed to land a job at National Semiconductor right out of college, which was very impressive because the U.S. was in the middle of a recession, and it was very difficult to find work, period. And he sort of was at the intersection of hardware and software. He has said in interviews since that he's always been really a hardware guy, and he really only does programming because he has to make his games. And this sort of bears out here. He was developing hardware to test integrated circuits without needing to do it by hand, which was a miserable experience by all accounts. And while he was there, he befriended Alan Miller, who would go on to work at Atari. And he would recruit David Crane as part of their second wave of consumer developers. His first game came out in 1978. It was Outlaw. That was an unlicensed conversion of a Midway arcade game called Gunfight. And he worked on a few other things while he was at Atari. He developed a couple more VCS games, Slot Machine, which was basically just written for his mother because she's a big slots nerd. there was Canyon Bomber, which was another Atari port of an arcade game. And he also joined... Alan Miller and Larry Kaplan in sort of salvaging the operating system for the Atari 400 and 800 computer. Basically, the company was extremely behind on putting that together. The people they contracted to do it, they were not getting the job done. So they gave those three 12 weeks to finish that project and get it out the door in time for them to start shipping. So they managed to pull that one off. Apparently, it was very grueling. And over the course of this, he sort of realized, you know, the Atari approach to these games is you've got a very simple game and then you make a million different options, right? So for Outlaw, you've got all these different game modes where sometimes there's moving objects, sometimes you can blow through objects, sometimes it's just like a single player target shooting thing. And he realized he didn't like that approach. He liked making a game that on its own was extremely good, had all the elements he wanted, and you get to play what he came up with.
Is he the reason that that game console makers got rid of all the switches on their systems and you could just really just play like one game mode? Is that his doing?
You know, I think we can pin that right on David Crane.
Wow, way to go, David.
Oh, nice going, David.
Yeah, so by the time Pitfall came along in about August 1982, he had a reputation. He was really well known both inside the industry and out as someone who was quote-unquote a genius. I've seen that several times in newspaper articles about this guy. And he was helping out his fellow coworkers on, you know, graphic stuff, like he did the Mad Bomber for the Kaboom. He had written 2 million plus sellers. He did Freeway and Laser Blast for Activision. So he was doing really well for himself. And his sort of design mentality around these 2600 games was that he would be working on some sort of like technical graphical feat on the hardware. And once he'd gotten that to look really cool, he decided to build a game around it. So for, I know Grand Prix was one that he did just before Pitfall, and that was built entirely around him coming up with a way to make a car that was sort of multicolor and had animation and could scroll smoothly on and off screen. That was what he built a whole racing game around. And for Pitfall, it was a running animation.
I had heard that, and that's different than the Intellivision Running Man animation, right? Because that's kind of the famous thing, I think, with Intellivision.
Yes. This was a separate running animation, which is funny because he did, well, he didn't do it, but they did port Pitfall to the Intellivision, and I think they just used
the Running Man's, like, routine.
They used his Running Man and not the Intellivision one, so.
Wow. Breaking from a tradition, my God. Well, also, his Running Man could do more than merely run. He could jump and fall into holes.
And swing on vines.
Oh, yeah, and climb. He could climb stuff, too. So that's a whole lot of things happening at once. So what a versatile little guy this Pitfall Harry was. So maybe we should talk about Pitfall and Pitfall Harry. Yeah, so Pitfall was, you know, even though I wasn't playing video games at the time at home because I didn't have a home video game system, that was one of those games that you just were kind of aware of it, whether you saw it at a grocery store or a friend of yours owned an Atari with Pitfall or you saw commercials for it. That was where Jack Black got his start as an actor, playing the young pith helmet wearing enthusiast of Pitfall in a commercial for the game.
The commercials for Activision games in general are absolutely awesome, and I assume they're all on YouTube, but if you don't know it, go and look at the one for Mega Mania. It's just peak. It's so good.
Yeah, they put some money into those commercials. Just not just Activision, but video games had great commercials back at the time. Lots of live action intercut with animation, intercut with game footage. It was a heady era, not like now, but yeah. So Pitfall was it was pretty ubiquitous, and I think the quality of it sold. You know, Activision had their patch system where if you performed certain goals in video games, you could send a photograph of your screen, which was, you know, authentic back then because it was very difficult to fake that kind of thing in a photograph at the time. There was no Photoshop, no AI to generate a fake image for you.
It's like achievements, but meet space, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. Really, you take cool. A photograph of whatever objective they had defined for you, mail that to Activision, and then they would send you a patch that you could, you know, iron onto your Letterman jacket or whatever, you know, because it was definitely the college Letterman who were the high scoring achievers in Activision games for sure.
I want to note super quickly that in that compilation Activision anthology, they did include that if you meet those goals, you will unlock the patch in the game, which I thought was really cool.
Hmm. Yeah, those were great. I had the Game Boy Advance version of that collection and it does the same thing. And
I want that so bad. It's such a cool cartridge.
Then you can actually bring up the patch on your Game Boy and then sew your Game Boy onto your Letterman jacket. And
or into your skin.
Or onto your skin, yes. You could just fuse it into your flesh is what I'm hearing here.
Yeah, Activision should bring that back. You know, if you do really well in Call of Duty, you could get your own patch.
If you get enough kill streaks, they'll send you a patch. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So, you know, that was also a compelling element for Pitfall because it was a very objective based game. There is a way to, you know, basically have a perfect game, which is to collect all the treasures before time runs out. And so, you know, I think that speaks well to David Crane's philosophy of just have one game mode and make it really, really good. I'm trying to imagine Pitfall with lots of different game modes. Like, what would those be? Would it just be like the infinite alligator head hopper, or like, I don't even know what you would do, but
maybe I haven't got a clue at all. Maybe a mode with no time limit. We have to play through all of the different screens or something. I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there could have been options, but the game that we received, Crane settled on a really compelling and challenging set of objectives, which is collect, 32 treasures within 20 minutes. But the thing is, this is a very big game. This is not like Donkey Kong, where you have a single screen and there's like three things you can pick up as a bonus. It is a sprawling Mebius loop of a jungle with parallel paths above and below ground. Lots of hazards and treasures just sort of scattered around mysteriously in random places. Not random. They were not actually random. They were set, but you know, there was no way to know where a treasure was going to be until you stumbled across it. But it was one of the, maybe the first action game that you could actually map, as opposed to, you know, like you would map Colossal Cave Adventure or Zork or something. But an action game was almost always just a single screen or, you know, a couple of screens, and it was very simple. Whereas Pitfall was immense, and it had a very complicated, not immediately intuitive, kind of design element to it that involved shortcuts. And so it was really designed as a game for you to spend some time with and try to figure out, like, how do I actually accomplish this goal, because I don't know that it's possible to visit all 256 or 252 or whatever it is. It's nearly, you know, hitting the top of the 8-bit register.
It's 255.
Okay, so yeah, whoa. it's hitting the register and then leaving one little bit free.
So some of those screens are just the same, right? I'm not sorry. I don't mean to be ignorant, but they're not all completely different. They are. Some of them are just like the three alligators over and over again. Or
well, there's a set number of elements that he sort of mixes and matches in there. I'm pretty sure they repeat a few times, but that's just like the upper level. There's also a lower level.
That's not really criticizing it or anything. I just wanted to be sure. I remember when I do play this. To be honest with you, the first time I've known what you're supposed to do is today, when I looked at the notes here. I would just run around collecting treasures till I died and have a fun time. I didn't really care about finishing it. In fact, I wasn't even convinced you could finish it. I thought it was just a get a higher score you can in 20 minutes kind of game. But I guess it is, in a sense.
Yeah, if you finish the game, if you collect all the treasures in the time limit, it does like stop with like the timer still going. The timer stops too, but it stops counting down. And
is there any kind of like celebratory like noise or like text or?
I don't remember. I've never actually finished
I don't think anyone's finished this.
Probably doesn't do that actually.
You can find a playthrough of it on YouTube. But yeah, you need to have mapped it out, and if you follow the path correctly, you'll have like 20 seconds left over. There's very little time to mess around.
See,
in this game.
That interests me because I'm sort of charting a line between this and A Boy and His Blob, which is David Crane, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they aren't the same, but there is a similarity in the sense that they're kind of about mapping and memorizing and figuring out what to do where and how, but you know, in a less, maybe a less stressful way than Pitfall.
Yeah, it's interesting. We could talk about A Boy and His Blob.
It
really is like the actual Pitfall 3 in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
With the blob taking the place of Quick Claw, I guess. But anyway, we can talk about that later. But yeah, no, there's a real lineage from Pitfall to Pitfall 2 to A Boy and His Blob.
Hmm.
And if you watch my video series, Metroidvania Works, on YouTube, you will see all three of these games covered in sequence and learn more about that. But yeah, the structure of Pitfall's jungle is really interesting and not immediately intuitive. And it's really, like I said, the kind of game that you were meant to spend a long time with and sort of puzzle things out and start to notice discrepancies like, hey, how come when I run along the surface, I see these screens in succession, but if I run along the bottom, I see a different set of screens? What's going on there? And, you know, it's made a little more difficult by the fact that, as you said, Stuart, so many of the screens are identical. Like, there's only so many ways you can draw three alligators in a pit of water with a vine swinging over them or not. You know, when you've got 255 screens and just like just a handful of elements, you're going to see a lot of repetition. It's kind of like the cloud and bush thing in Super Mario Brothers. There's a lot of recycling of code just to fit within that space. And, you know, the fact that Crane managed to fit 256 quote unquote unique screens into an Atari 2600 cartridge is pretty remarkable. You know, yeah. The elements include pools of water. You can have bogs of black tar that expand and contract. You can have alligators in the water or not. You can have vines overhead or not. You can have a hole. You can have a scorpion underground. You can have a snake on the ground, and you can have treasures. And there might be a wall or a ladder underground and leading to the surface. But that's it. That's pretty much all there is to Pitfall. So it's a very limited palette of elements. And, you know, I think that kind of leads to some of the challenge of the game, because you do have to sort of recognize the patterns that you see unfolding as you play and, you know, memorize. You know, when I get to the alligator screen after the bog screen, but there's no vine at the bog, then the next screen is going to be where I have to go to the tunnel below and then jump ahead and use the kind of shortcut, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yep. It's similar to a lot of micro games that I would have played, but as I said, I just think it's inherently fun to play, even if you don't really expect to finish it or don't really care about finishing it. It sounds like finishing it is so like regimented, like you have to do these steps in this specific order, that it's probably more fun not to try and finish it, you know. Just go off and do your own thing, you know, go left at the start instead of right, what the hell.
And you can do that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You couldn't do that in Donkey Kong. You try to go left at the start, and that fireball is going to fry your ass in like 5 seconds. So very innovative in that sense. No, I mean, the complexity of Pitfall is really not evident when you first play it. And, you know, obviously there were instruction manuals back in the day, and you could read that and see what your goals were. But even if you just, you know, pick it up unknowing, and you can immediately intuit what you're supposed to do, run, jump, avoid hazards, go up and down between the surface and the ground, underground. But, you know, I think it's one of those games where you start to wonder, is there more to this, and how does that work? And it's, you know, just kind of like a little simple action puzzle for you to figure out and, you know, share tips with your friends and say, well, you know, I discovered that if I go here and do this at such a time, then a thing will happen and it'll lead me to, you know, the money bag or whatever.
I love the use of sound in this game. It's very sparing, but it's very funny. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the Tarzan cry when you swing on the vines, or when you fall down and it makes that just brrr sound. It's just fantastic. I love it. The jump sound as well is just perfect.
I love the little fanfare when you pick up one of the treasures.
Oh yeah. Da-da-da-da-da.
It's like, that's cute. That's a cute little touch.
It's lovely aesthetically in general. I just can't not love Pitfall, and everything about it is just crystallized. It's great.
I also love that, I don't know, for whatever reason, I never read the silver bars as actually silver as a kid. I always, like, my sister and I are like, oh yeah, that's the purple gold.
That's the bricks of coal.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, you added a lot of notes here. Do you want to go over anything that we haven't touched on so far?
Yeah, I can touch on a couple of things. So I know David Crane's talked a little bit about the development of this game. And one of the things that really jumped out at me is the inspirations for it. Obviously, Indiana Jones. He said specifically that's where he got the jungle theme from. So he was pulling from the beginning of Raiders. And, you know, Tarzan was another big one. The swing vine was very obviously Tarzan with the cry and everything. He called this Jungle Runner, and that almost was what it was released under. But he wasn't a huge fan of the name, and he settled eventually on Pitfall because he is a big fan of puns. And, you know, it's a game about trying not to fall in pits. Pretty straightforward. And I also liked reading that until very late in development, this game had only one life. You were expected to get through this whole thing in one go, which is extremely a microcomputer thing.
It's rather punishing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But all of his coworkers complained about it and told him it was a terrible idea. And eventually he came around to agreeing with them. And he actually had to, like, because this game was so crammed full of code for the cartridge size, he actually had to reduce the graphical fidelity a little bit just to fit in having little tally marks for your lives as a lives counter. So if you dig around online, you can find a beta build of this game that has tree branches that aren't there in the retail version and only one life.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So Pitfall Harry stole his life from the trees, is what you're saying.
Yes, he did. He's a necromancer.
Difficulty discourse has been around since 1980.
Now we know where the endwives went.
Oh, no.
Buddy gatekeeping, David Crane.
And this game did extremely well for, you know, David Crane and the company. I found an interview with Jim Levy from 1984 where he says that they'd sold 3.5 million copies of it by that point. I've seen some later interviews round that up to 4 million. I don't know if there's a discrepancy there, if those ones are counting some of the ports that the game had pushed around.
If an Activision game sold 4 million these days and it didn't sell that on day one, it would be considered a huge failure.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating.
Everyone would be sacked. Well, actually, if it sold 40 million, they would still be sacked anyway, just because that's what they do.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Activision turned into an evil company so gradually. You never even noticed.
No, it really happened when Bobby Kotick took over. They changed their name to...
It became evil immediately.
what was their brief name?
It was Mediagenic in Mediagenic. The late 80s when they were trying to branch out beyond just games. Like, at that point, Activision was their... publishing name.
Their albatross.
Yeah. It was their imprint.
The horrible past that they wore around their neck.
The imprint for their video games, and then Mediagenic was what they used for all of their other sort of software, and it went absolutely nowhere, and they were on their way out, basically.
Wow.
But yeah, so this makes it one of the best-selling games on the VCS, the 2600. I think Pac-Man did much better than it. That's like 8 million copies or something.
Wow.
Pitfall's in the same vein as, you know, Space Invaders or Frogger or Defender, Demon Attack, all these other really big sellers. And other than Demon Attack, these are all also arcade ports of big arcade hits. So I think that makes Pitfall particularly special in that regard, because this game was good enough that even though it didn't have the name branding of something like Space Invaders, that people flocked to it. And it's probably a reason why Atari's own Raiders of the Lost Ark game that came out a couple months later just kind of bombed.
Aw. Poor Howard Scott Warshaw.
Mm-hmm. He tried so hard. And
it was bad news for him from start to finish.
Flew too close to the sun.
He's like the nicest guy ever. It sucks. It'll be bad for him.
That's why things go so badly for him in the video games industry. You can't be nice in this business. It's cutthroat.
Yeah.
And it did get ported around. Like, they had it on 2600, obviously. They put it on the Intellivision, the Atari computer line, the 5200. The Commodore 64 had a version. The ColecoVision has a version that was done by Action Graphics.
I don't think I ever saw it for ColecoVision. Wow.
I've only seen it a few times. I think it was a later release and therefore not a huge seller.
That was like 20 of the copies from that 4 million.
Kevin, would you say which would you say is the best version of the original?
Oh, I'd call the 2600 version the best one.
All right, right on.
I think the other ones, either they look identical to it, but have a much funkier controller, or they look weird.
Oh, yeah, playing that on the Intellivision disc. Wow. Wow.
I've done it. It's an experience.
Why would you do that? Yeah. Man, okay. Well, anyway, I do want to talk about other Pitfall games besides Pitfall. So, any final thoughts on the original Pitfall? Actually, it's Pitfall with an exclamation point. We've been saying it wrong the whole time.
No, we have to redo the whole podcast.
We have to say Pitfall.
That's really good. Start you should over. Check it out.
Pitfall!
You know, that should be like, instead of the Sega scream, that can be the Activision scream. They just scream, Pitfall!
Pitfall!
Well, you know, maybe Microsoft will bring back Pitfall like they did Battletoads. They'll put Pitfall Harry and Killer Instinct and, and Shovel Knight.
Oh, no. Good Lord. It's better than the running game, I guess.
Ah, yes. And we'll get to that.
Then we won't.
But first, I'd like to recommend a quick break. Good to resume?
Yeah.
Stuart, you are in the process of caffeination now?
Yes.
Excellent. Caffeine. What a great drug.
Mm-hmm.
You know who didn't have to worry about caffeine? Pitfall Harry.
Because
he's high on life.
Adventure.
And also being eaten by alligators.
And also licking toads that he finds in the jungle.
That's true, yeah. You know? The game actually is, really, he's just like sitting around under a tree and he's just having hallucinations about running around being a hero because of all the toads. Anyway.
He's actually called Pitiful Harry.
I do think that Pitfall 2 could be explained to some degree by it being a hallucination because it changes up a lot. And also, like, a sentient mountain lion is involved and there's ballooning. Pitfall 2 goes places.
It's a lot.
But in terms of game design, if you're not looking for, you know, logic or coherency, is kind of an amazing leap forward. This was a 1984 game following on the heels of 1982's Pitfall, one of the last, maybe the last notable game for Atari, original game for Atari 2600, released in the doldrums of the video games industry in America, the console industry, just a really terrible time for a game like this to come out. And as a result, it's actually relatively rare and fairly expensive to get a hold of.
That's very surprising.
At this point, isn't it though?
Yeah.
But Pitfall 2 was Pitfall, but just expanded on multiple axes. Actually, no, it was contracted on the horizontal axis. It is no longer an infinitely scrolling Mebius loop through a jungle, but instead you go beneath the jungle into the Lost Caverns of the title. Pitfall 2 Lost Caverns is the title. And it's really cool and really, really ambitious for a 2600 game. And also makes a definitive statement about the difficulty discourse, which is to say, who cares if you die? Go ahead and die. It just means you can't get the best possible score. And that's a really interesting approach to take. So that's probably the first thing you might notice when you play Pitfall 2, besides the fact that you can't keep going right as long as you want. You can't go left at all from the starting screen. But once you get to the rightmost point, you can go down into caverns. And so now it's about 256-ish screens. I think it's 240-something.
Oh, boy.
But it's, you know, across and down. So it's this massive grid of interconnected screens, and you're still collecting treasures. But if you die, you don't have to, like, you don't respawn immediately on the same point where you died. And if you die three times, you can still keep playing because there is no lives counter. Instead, there are little crosses on the ground. And anytime you pass over a cross, whenever you die, you are sent back to that cross, and your score decrements while you are in transition from the point of your death to the respawn point. So the more times you die, the lower your score. And the further you are from a respawn point when you die, the more your score is affected. But ultimately, you're awarded points for collecting treasures and deducted points for messing up. And the you know, a perfect game is collecting all the treasures without dying, which is every bit as difficult as completing Pitfall 2, or the original Pitfall, with all the treasures, but in a different way. It just requires you to learn and memorize a different aspect of the game. And the underground spaces now obviously are much more complex and much less about like pattern recognition and more about actually learning the geography. And, again, a very significant game in the sort of evolution of exploratory platforming, or as we call them in cool places, Metroidvanias.
So is there, I'm not as familiar with this one. I've only played it briefly, but is there a sort of a sandbox-ish feel to it with the infinite lives, no fall damage, no time limit? You're just in until you feel done. Like, there's no game over. It's like you're there until you're done. And that's interesting. That's really quite rare. The fact that this game's got music is probably the thing I would first notice when I started playing it, though, because rare for an Atari game.
Well, it maybe Kevin can speak to that.
Yeah, I think, it had like a chip, didn't it? Like an additional...
Yes, it has the DPC chip, which was designed by David Crane, going back to his roots as a hardware engineer. And his concept for this was that he wanted an add-on chip for Activision cartridges that could drag out the 2600's useful life a few more years. Functionally, this is the only Activision game that used it, because they only put out like a handful of carts after this point, as the market for 2600 games was just collapsing rapidly. But it's essentially a graphics coprocessor and a music generator, so it can perform three-channel harmonics, which the 2600 itself is completely incapable of. You get two channels, and you don't even get like a full note scale on the base hardware. But Pitfall 2, it can do it. My understanding is that it checks what the music should be doing every single scan line of the screen.
Wow. So that seems like a lot of processing time burned up just on that one routine.
Well, that's why it gets its own special chip.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. So it checks that every scan line, and if you do something that requires the music to change tempo or the keys, it'll do that. So, like, typically it's just sort of playing a loop of the theme song from the Pitfall cartoon that had come out by this point. And, you know, David Crane just did basically a console rendition of that. But if you die, it goes into like a minor key and slows down a little bit for however many seconds. If you pick up a treasure, it like picks up a little bit for a couple seconds.
Was this the first video game to have dynamic contextual music?
I think so. I was trying to think of the word, and dynamic, I think, is what I was looking for. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that if it's not the first, it's one of the firsts. And it's another thing about this game that makes me so mad that it came out in 1984 when nobody was really, you know, paying attention. Because it shouldn't have been forward-thinking. It should have just been like, oh, this is great. We should pull from this for our future games. Mm. But nobody really did that at the time.
I guess Dig Dug technically had contextual music in that it only plays when Dig Dug is walking. Taizo Hori, if you prefer. Mm. So you've got the little banjo theme that plays as he's walking around and stops when he stops walking around. But that's all I can think of in terms of contextual or like dynamic music.
The only stuff I can think of, I think, is later, so it's not worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. what sprung to my mind was Bubble Bubble, but that's like 2 years later, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's really just a hurry-up theme. It doesn't really change.
Dun.
Yeah. Is it also the first video game to have a built-in coprocessor chip for enhancements?
Let me think. I'm not positive. I think it might be one of the first. I know there's a few 2600 games with additional RAM on cart. I don't know if you want to count that as a coprocessor.
I wouldn't. I mean, that's RAM is not like doing, you know, calculations. It's just letting you crunch bigger numbers.
Yeah. So in that case, probably, yeah. I think that's a good contender for that. And I also enjoyed learning that apparently the reason this game has checkpoints is because David Crane couldn't get a save feature to work on the hardware because, you know, they didn't have a battery-backed arrangement for these things yet. So he figured, well, if I put in checkpoints, at the least, then you could finish it in one go.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Battery backups in video games debuted in 85 with the Super Cassette Vision, and you had to stick your own AA batteries in there. So, yeah. Huh. Interesting. Okay, so basically, this game is a technical marvel. I mean, just in terms of the size, you know, it's actually somewhat fewer screens than Atari, the original Pitfall for Atari, but it's still bigger. I mean, realistically, it's not just, you know, the same set of elements used over and over again. And admittedly, there are a lot of screens in the underground that are just big, empty blanks. Oh yeah, there's no fall damage in this game. Like, you can jump from impossible heights, and it's like the opposite of Mario. Like, Pitfall Harry, this is why you know he's hallucinating, because you can jump from, like, 10 screens high and land, and you just keep doing your Running Man animation. But yeah, there are a lot of screens where it's just a yawning chasm of black, and you have to figure out how to get across that. So it's very puzzle-ish, learning to use all the different elements within the game, and figuring out how to traverse things, making it past certain obstacles, learning to dodge leaping frogs and things like that. There's a lot of twitch skills and timing that are required, in addition to the ability to just kind of create a map with your brain and on paper and chart things out. It's a really cool, really, really innovative game.
And if you check out the Atari computer or 5200 versions, there's a whole second quest in the game as well, because the developer of those ones, Mike Lorenzen, he had extra time, I think a whole month, after finishing the port before it actually had to ship. So he went ahead and just added in a whole second, cavern maze to get through, just for funsies.
Hmm.
And according to David Crane, he's like, yeah, you know, this was sort of a competition to see which approach would be the right one for porting this game around, because this and the Commodore 64 port were started at the same time, and they had the same schedule for when they needed to be done. And Lorenzen just took Crane's 2600 code and, like, modified it to work on the 8-bits, whereas the other guy, whose name is escaping me, he rewrote the game from the ground up for the Commodore, and Lorenzen's approach, basically, like, the code was already debugged, so once he got it working, it was working, whereas the Commodore version, it took longer to get through all the bug testing stages, so no extras there.
Huh. How about that? So that's a cool little thing that they did. And it's cool that Crane was okay with him saying that, with Lorenzen saying, hey, I'm going to, like, add my entire thing to your game.
Yeah, he was fine with it. Usually Activision's approach was that every game had to be had to play and, like, seem identical on every platform. But this is one of those little exceptions where they let you have a little bonus if you had the 8-bit computers or a 5200.
Nice. So, you mentioned something earlier that we were going to talk about at the end of the show, but I guess it is important to talk about now, and that's Saturday's Supercade and the fact that this game incorporates plot mechanics or plot elements from the cartoon spinoff that showed up on Saturday mornings. And this wasn't the only 1984 game to do that. Pac-Land by Namco also really kind of leans into the, was it Hanna-Barbera cartoon?
Yeah.
From the American cartoon. And then Namco back in Japan was like, yeah, okay, sure. Let's, let's give the ghosts, fishing caps and stuff. Why not?
Pitfall, Saturday Supercade, that wasn't Hanna-Barbera, was it? That was like
Ruby Spears,
yeah. It didn't even reach the quality of Hanna-Barbera.
No. I've never seen this, but I know it exists.
A bit of it, and it's just like, nah.
Yeah, we recently talked about the different adaptations of Mario, like screen interpretations of Mario at PAX. It was one of Bob's panels. I think he was surprised that even though I grew up contemporaneously with Saturday Supercade, I never watched it because even at, you know, the age of 7 or whatever, I just saw that and was like, this seems like crap. So like all those cartoons, like, Q-Bert, Donkey Kong, and of course Pitfall, I had no interest in them. I saw them and I was like, well, time to turn the channel and see what's on a different station, watch some better cartoon, maybe The Littles or something.
It's interesting that this was the sole like console game in that lineup, though. All the other Supercade spin-offs or adaptations, those were all based on arcade games. So this was sort of the first big licensed out console game, something you'd see a million times with Mario in just a couple of years.
Go ahead, Stuart.
Jeremy, you mentioned that there was a Q-Bert cartoon?
Yes, as part of Saturday Supercade.
Oh, how the hell did one of... Never mind, I don't need to know.
it's really terrible. Yeah, shockingly bad.
I bet it is. Does he swear in it like he does in the game? Does he say fuck?
Yes, he does.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he directly looks at the camera. So he's looking at the children and says,
whoa.
It's terrible. Terrible. We should probably bleep that out, actually.
That's the word even I try not to say, even though normally I say it all the time.
You do say it a lot, actually.
I try not to, but I can't help it.
I was just trying to imagine what would be the most shocking thing for a Saturday morning cartoon to say to children. And that kind of jumped out at me. Anyway... No, the Q-Bert cartoon is terrible, and I assume the Pitfall cartoon is terrible also, but, you know, there are just some levels of research I am not willing to commit to for Retronauts, and watching bad Saturday morning cartoons is way up there. Like, I have a real aversion to media interpretations of video game stuff, and I always have, and maybe it's because of Saturday Supercade, now that I think about it, because, like I said, even as a kid... I could tell like there were the good cartoons on TV and the bad cartoons just based on animation quality and substance. I would always watch The Littles because it had gorgeous animation, which it turns out it was like by TMS or something, you know, like a Japanese studio. So yeah. I was a weeaboo even before I even knew what Japan was. It was amazing.
I think it's funny. It was when people say things like kids like we'll watch anything. And I'm like, never watched anything.
Absolutely
like,
not.
I would wake up and put the TV on and it would be Captain N and I'd be like, I'm not watching this.
I'd go read like the newspaper comics or something instead of watching a bad cartoon.
Kids are discerning, very discerning.
Yeah. Maybe, sir, your children are stupid and have no taste, but the rest of them are actually quite wise.
I knew what to do. I'd wait for the raccoons to be nearly over and then tune in so I could listen to that song at the end and not watch the show. Bert Raccoon, the most boring twat.
Over here we had Matlock for that.
Yeah.
Was there a Matlock cartoon? I missed that one.
But Matlock played right before some of the shows I'd watch as a kid, so I became very familiar with the end credits theme right before my cartoons would start.
Matlock.
are you like putting together improvising a Matlock cartoon theme?
No, I was just doing the Simpsons bit. Yep. We want Matlock.
Oh,
Matlock. I wasn't coming up with something original. Come on.
I got his pills.
All right. Anyway, so Pitfall 2, pretty amazing. I was aware that it existed back in the day because I went to a friend's house and they had a bunch of video games, including Pitfall 2. That child was wise, and also his parents were wealthy, and I was neither wise nor wealthy. So it eluded my awareness for many years until I started to put together Metroidvania works and was like, oh, this seems really important. And then I discovered that, weirdly enough, there was an arcade interpretation of Pitfall 2, which had nothing to do with Activision. It was licensed to Activision, licensed by Activision to Sega. So there was this kind of strange trend of Sega and IRIM especially taking Western computer and console properties, mostly computer, and turning them into arcade machines such as Lode Runner and Choplifter. And one of those was Pitfall 2. And Sega's interpretation of Pitfall 2 has very little to do with Pitfall 2. I mean, yes, it's kind of structured the same in that there you start on the surface and then you go down, but it's more of an arcade game, which is to say it doesn't have the checkpoints. It has three lives, and the progress you make through the underground is extremely linear. It's not 100% linear, but it's much more linear. It's like you start out going along the ground, and then when you reach the end, that's kind of a new stage, and you go down, and then you go left for the next stage. So it's kind of like taking the concept of exploring the underground and putting it on rails, which is an interesting choice. It's pretty difficult, and it looks pretty nice. I like the graphics they came up with for it.
They sort of screwed up Pitfall Harry's running, though. He looks really goofy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the character animation is goofy, but yeah. The actual background graphics look pretty nice.
Yeah, it's nice, pleasant, yeah.
Yeah, it's much more detailed, obviously, than an Atari 2600 game. I think it was like a System 1 game, so yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right.
The backgrounds have got serious Pac-Land vibes going on.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And then, of course, Sega being Sega, they said, hey, we should put this game on our home console, which at the time was the SG-1000. I believe the Mark III had come out by that point or was coming out very soon, the Mark III being the Master System, but they were still really focused on the SG-1000. So they created a game that was a weird sort of hybrid of the Atari version and the arcade version. So it still loses the checkpoint system and gives you three lives, but it's much less linear once you get underground than the arcade version. And as a result, I can't imagine that any living human has seen the end of this game. It's so difficult because you have to do all the exploring and running around and getting on hot air balloons and flying up into the caverns and all of that, but on three lives with, you know, the SG-1000 controller, which is not exactly the best way to play any video game. But they did it, by God. And because it is a card game, a My Card game, you can easily play it on the Sega Mark III. But as you may know, the Sega Mark III, the Master System, has a different color palette, a different, you know, different color capabilities entirely from the SG-1000. So when you play SG-1000 games on Mark III, they tend to look way too dark, especially like the blues. The colors are a lot more garish and harsh as opposed to sort of the soft pastels of the SG-1000. But the according to Nicole Express's blog, the SG-1000 version of Pitfall is one of the few My Cards for that system that has a special option built in to recognize when it's plugged into a Mark III and switch to a different color palette that isn't quite the same as the SG-1000, but works a lot better so that you can actually have that compatibility mode and see what the hell you're doing underground. So I think they were kind of banking on this game to be a big deal, I guess. I don't know.
I'm surprised they didn't bring it out here.
For SG-1000?
Well, for Master System.
Yeah, visually it wouldn't have been up to snuff. I mean, if you look at even something like, you know, My Hero or Ghost House, Pitfall 2 just doesn't look that good. So I don't think they could have brought over an SG-1000 game. I mean, it's very limited compared to Master System games proper.
They had Monty Zimmer's Revenge at this point, which was probably filling that gap a little bit.
On Master System?
I think so. I want to say
that
yes.
Was like 1989.
Really?
This was 85.
Man, I've made this podcast really just ruined it.
No, it's okay. I only know this because I'm spending way too much time with 8-bit Sega these days.
I thought it was like 84 or something, but maybe I'm thinking of the home computer version.
That was the home computer version. Yeah,
the original version's like 84. So
yeah, and it wasn't even until 1988 that third parties were publishing on Master System in the U.S. So
wow,
that came along later. But anyway, have either of you played these versions of Pitfall 2?
I've played a little bit of the arcade version, and I don't really like it because they took away everything I liked about Pitfall 2.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just an arcade game. It's no longer like a cool, revolutionary home game.
I've played the original on, you know, compilations and things, and I don't like it as much as... I think it's a better game, but I don't like it as much as the first one, because the first one is just much sort of simpler and a little bit, I think slightly nicer looking. But I'd like to get back to Lost Caverns and, you know, give it the old college try at some point properly.
So that was it for David Crane and the world of Pitfall. But I did not realize this. However, Kevin added a cool note to his comments and the document for this episode about a mysterious third Pitfall game. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I corresponded with David Crane some years ago for my, you know, Atari Archive video series, and he mentioned to me that he was in the planning stages for a Pitfall 3 that he was going to be on the Commodore 64 when he finally left Activision because of a shakeup in the senior management. He didn't go into too many details at that point, but in the same, you know, breath, basically, he told me he was planning to make a lot of different versions of Pitfall, because with this sort of screen-to-screen paradigm, you could basically have Pitfall Harry go through different environments, like a jungle to a city, to a dock, to the ocean, etc. And the way he put it was that it would have to wait for a bigger and better game console to fit a larger world, in this case, compared to a 2600. Hmm. So I suspect that's kind of what he had in mind for Pitfall 3. But yeah, didn't really go anywhere. And then other developers who were making platformers for like the NES got the chance to sort of run with that idea.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, Crane left Activision, so he no longer had a legal connection to the Pitfall series. So that exactly. kind of just severed the rope and sent him plunging into the non-pits, I guess, away from the pits. No more Pitfalls for him. You know, so I'm looking at the fact that we've already gone for like an hour and 10 minutes or so. And as people may know, I do not breathe while recording Retronauts. So I have a 90 minute limit before my oxygen runs out.
It's so fucking impressive.
I'm practicing for swimming the English Channel, but I only doggy paddle. So it'll be really slow. So I gotta really practice on that. No, I feel like this is going to be another one of those Retronauts episodes where we break it into two. So maybe we should do this. I'm just throwing this out here so that we can actually properly talk about the later games, which Stuart loves dearly, or at least one of them.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about the David Crane Pitfall games this episode and then have another episode talking about everyone else's Pitfall games, including Super Pitfall?
Yeah, I think splitting that off is sensible, because that one can be a bit more involved, and Mine Adventure can be a bit involved, and then Lost Exposition is where it gets to the sort of kind of like, yeah, it's a platformer, you know, it's not much to say about it, but the other stuff we can talk about for sure.
So yeah, maybe we could reconvene in a couple of weeks and talk some more about
Yeah, that'd be great.
Should be fine.
Cool. So, with that being said, there is one more David Crane Pitfall game, and we talked about that earlier, and that is Absolute Entertainment's and Imagineering's A Boy and His Blob, Trouble on Blobalonia, as well as The Rescue of Princess Blobette. So that's two games, although they're kind of just the same game.
So I should mention, recently have been put out as a compilation as well. You can buy them
they
on
have,
Switch
yes.
and such, yeah.
Yes, I don't want to turn this into something self-serving, although I don't actually make any money off of it, so I might as well. You can buy those digitally through Limited Run Games as part of our Carbon Engine line, and I don't know why we did that. It was one of those surprising, like, oh, we're doing this. Okay. But it's kind of cool because there is some history behind these games, and they are part of a legacy and a lineage. And it is unfortunate that, you know, there's the whole corporate thing in there kind of breaking stuff off, because I feel like a collection of Pitfall 2, and then A Boy and His Blob would be really, really cool, especially if you got all the different versions in there. But alas, that is not to be. So we're just going to talk about the NES game and the Game Boy game here, because those are the only ones that are kind of, you know, available now for easy acquisition.
I want to mention just like, I think that in Call of Duty World War II, you can play Pitfall 1 and 2. Like, inexplicably, they're in there. There's like a rest, there's like an R&R place you can go to in the game that's got arcade machines for some reason. It's World War II, for Christ's sake. And you can play stuff like River Raid, and you can play, I'm pretty sure Pitfall is one of them, and it's just utterly bizarre.
Yeah, I know there's a, I think, a Call of Duty game where you can play some Infocom text adventures.
Yeah, that's Black Ops, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Since Activision bought Infocom during its mediagenic phase.
I'm just so mad that they don't just put out a compilation. Like, we've got Atari 50, which was incredible, and only briefly mentions Activision. If we could get, like, Activision 50 or something.
That would be nice.
I would love that. I just want those games on a modern system, because they're still fun.
So the thing that I've kind of discovered through just observation and also from hearing conversations with people who work with these companies is that generally companies, game publishers that publish new, current, you know, top of the line software that are always pressing forward, don't really like to look back that much. I mean, Nintendo doesn't actually dwell on its history nearly as much as they could.
Yeah.
I mean, they give you Nintendo Switch Online. They had Virtual Console before that, but it's like, how can we nickel and dime gamers to death? I know, let's put out Donkey Kong on paper cards that you can scan onto your Game Boy Advance. You know, they're just kind of like trying to find ways to monetize old stuff, but there's never been a proper Nintendo, like, here is our history. The closest you've gotten has been, you know, NES Remix, which was really cool, but, you know, playing like 10 seconds of Zelda 2 is not the same as playing Zelda 2, you know, for better or for worse, depending on your opinion of that game.
Yeah.
But yeah, like Activision, they're really focused on selling you their latest warmed over Call of Duty. I've seen the reviews of the new one, and it's not doing so great. They just don't want to, like, put out stuff that looks old and makes you think, oh, Activision, they're the company that has all this old stuff. I think that's stupid and superficial, but that's how executives think.
It sucks. It's really horrible. I was
sucks
hoping that
ass
with
is what
exactly
it sucks.
With Microsoft, I was hoping maybe Microsoft would do something cool, but that seems unlikely at this point.
Well, they did with Rare, so
yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, but that could also be a factor of the fact that Rare is not doing that much that's new and interesting these days. Like, Microsoft bought them, and they just kind of disappeared.
Sea of Thieves is making money, isn't it?
Yeah, they did Sea of Thieves. They were working on all those Kinect things for years.
Everwild or something? Just make Conker and Banjo, you fools.
Exactly.
They did make that new Banjo game like 10 years ago.
It was awesome. It was so good. Banjo Nuts and Bolts, what a great game. Let's go. More of that, please. It's great.
But yeah, Atari doesn't really have anything new. So they're like, you know, kind of like this shell corporation sitting on top of old stuff. And they're, I think, actually doing a really good job of exploring the old stuff over the past few years.
Yeah, they've Digital Eclipse, right? The Atari.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they definitely recognize, oh, Digital Eclipse, these guys know what they're doing with old stuff. But, I mean, even the Recharged games are
pretty good,
and they're going into, you know, they started with obvious stuff like Missile Command, but then they went into things like Black Widow. And some really kind of off the beaten path type stuff. And they picked up Stern, and they're actually releasing, you know, Stern games. Stuff like Berserk and Frenzy are both coming out as Replicate cabinets, which, you know, 10 years ago, who could have imagined? Oh, yes, I will be able to buy a working, like, perfectly formed miniature replica of Berserk. No,
yeah,
that's like bizarre. So
Berserk Recharged is out soon as well, and they're doing it. There's a remake of Haunted House as well. I think they did.
Berserk Recharge really, seems like a perfect idea. Like, yeah, that game really seems to really fit that kind of, like, neon vibe.
I should really check that out.
That's going to be cool.
But, yeah, they've got Haunted House, and they've got Atari Mania, and they're really digging into the history, which is great, because they've been they were dormant for such a long time, just making Atari flashback over and over again.
Yeah, I don't have any particular love for Atari and any of its, you know, post crash incarnations. Aside from Atari games, they made some really great arcade games before they were shut down or absorbed or whatever the hell happened to them. But I will say that Atari, as it exists now, seems to be kind of doing a good job with their legacy for the first time, and I'm kind of impressed.
Yeah, I mean, with Atari 50, and even before that, Atari Vault, they had the right idea going. But as always, I just say to them, basically, if you put a compilation out and it's got Major Havoc on it, we're good. Like, that's all they need. The order of the game is pale in comparison, but I absolutely love that game.
It is a good game.
So anyway, that was a sidebar. Hope you enjoyed it. But let's talk a little bit about A Boy and His Blob, which is very much Pitfall 2 Part 2, in a way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you're on the surface. You go into some caverns and look for treasure so you can buy jelly beans.
It feels like... I mean, I played it quite recently for review for the Retronauts site, and... it's a very fascinating game because I can see why, if you're in a certain mindset, you will immediately just be like, nah, no way, because it's not very friendly. Learning what the jelly beans do is pure, like, do it and then write it down. And then even then you need to know where exactly you need to use them because you have a limited number of them initially. So it's almost like a sandbox. It's like the sort of game where you'd go out in the playground and you'd be like, oh, I managed to get to this plate by doing this. And then someone else would be like, yeah, but you could do this to get here. And, you know, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the game does at least tell you, like, it gives you a hint, a visual hint for what each jelly bean does. It says, like, honey equals hummingbird, cinnamon equals torch, that sort of thing. Mm. But, yeah, like, figuring out exactly how you solve the puzzles. It's not the best designed game. I think... some of the powers are very underutilized. Some of them are relied on a little too much. It's actually a very small game once you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And once you get to the blob planet, Blobalonia, you really kind of need to have done everything right before getting there. Otherwise, you're just completely boned and there's no way to go forward. So it's kind of messy. I feel like it was probably coded somewhat hastily. It doesn't feel like... you know, listening to what Kevin was saying about David Crane's ideas for a third game, like, you can see, oh, yeah, there's the city. Oh, yeah, and then, you know, there's, like, water at the bottom, and you go to, like, a forest later. But it doesn't feel like he really got to explore the concepts that he really had in mind for a future Pitfall game. But at the same time, it does feel very much like... you know, a successor to Pitfall 2. And like I said earlier, in the original, it, like, the blob is very much Quick Claw Part 2. It's like,
yes.
Instead of being this little guy standing right below the starting point, just sitting there looking afraid, now he's your constant companion and he can do stuff and he's important to you. Like, the boy is in A Boy and His Blob, who has no name, is really kind of Pitfall Harry-ish in the sense that he doesn't have weapons. He's vulnerable to anything that you know, attacks him or hurts him, and to environmental perils. But he does have the advantage of being able to overcome these things by, you know, relying on his blob companion. So instead of, you know, having to go rescue some stupid mountain lion from the cartoon, now the mountain lion is an alien blob that looks kind of like a snowman with a horrible face and eats jelly beans. And when you feed the blob a jelly bean, it transforms into something keyed off of what those jelly beans taste like. And you have, like, an inventory you can cycle through. And every flavor does a different thing. And it's not immediately intuitive that you don't have access to all of the jelly beans from the start. You have to buy certain things at the drugstore that shows up right at the start of the game at the other side of the surface area. But, you know, once you figure that out, then you can advance to the alien planet and do your stuff. So there's really two goals in A Buena's Blob. First, you have to find your jelly bean bag. And once you find that, then you have to go to the store and buy a weapon. And then you go to the alien blob planet and fry the alien blob king that's taken over everything and is a horrible tyrant or whatever.
Mm. God, I played so much of this game as a kid and never finished it because it's kind of brutally difficult until you know exactly what to do.
Yep.
This game could have used the checkpoints from Pitfall 2.
Yeah, I really feel like having just a limited live system in this is very punishing. Like if kind of like the challenge factor here were just that you have a finite number of jelly beans to figure out the puzzles, I think that would have worked really well. I think, you know, they could have gotten a lot of mileage out of this, and it still wouldn't have been like a beat it in a rental kind of game if they had, you know, been more strict about the number of jelly beans that they ration and just let you keep dying until you run out of jelly beans and then, you know, say, oh, game over. You can't actually proceed any further. That would have been okay, but it's possible to get stuck in the style of a Sierra adventure if you don't know that you have to buy a vitamin blaster and you have to buy the vitamins. That's what you have to buy from the drugstore to power the vitamin blaster. That's the challenge. Now I'm remembering correctly. But it's possible to go to the alien planet and not be able to go back, you know, without having acquired the vitamins, at which point you're boned. You can't go any further. There's impossible situations that you cannot get through without the vitamin blaster.
It's the kind of esoteric that just makes me smile, you know, when you get yourself into a situation where the game is unwinnable and everyone gets mad, and I'm just like, yeah, I love it. As you mentioned Sierra Adventures, I'm just like, yes, mate, let's go.
Yeah, I think you mentioned this game theme seems like it was hastily put together, and that is my understanding of it. I remember seeing a talk that David Crane and Gary Kitchen gave some years ago, and I think they said as much, that they were basically working to get this game together in time for the Christmas season, and they just barely made it. So maybe it would have been a little more tuned if they weren't under such a time crunch, but
yeah,
it
seems a shame. There's some really good ideas here, and I feel like the game needed to gestate a little longer before being birthed into the world. But there's still a lot of appeal to it, and you know, as much as I like WayForward's take on A Buena's Blob that came 20 years later for Nintendo Wii, it has just the most charming graphics. It's such a warm, adorable looking game, and it has really good puzzles, but it loses the exploration element. It's just, you know, level by level. And I want the, like, the quality and the refinement of the WayForward game, but in the kind of Pitfall 2 structure, because this is very much, you know, Pitfall 2. You have the overworld and then you have the caverns beneath it. And, you know, I love the way the blob becomes this puzzle element. He's this, you know, constantly with you. It's constantly with you. I don't know the blob's pronoun. But the blob is constantly with you, and you have to feed it the right kind of jelly beans to get past each situation. And there's a lot of trial and error as you kind of figure this out. But, you know, there's a real Looney Tunes cartoon sense to it. I do think that the game is a little too reliant on English language puns to necessarily work in every language or every culture. You know, like cinnamon blowtorch. Okay, that's funny because cinnamon's hot, a blowtorch. But there's a few things like hole. The punch flavored jelly bean creates a hole, which, you know, you get it. You punch a hole. But does that translate necessarily into other languages? I don't know what kind of localization this had into Japanese, where it was called Fushigi na Burobi, which means the mysterious blob. And the blob was much cuter, and the boy was much cuter. It's like the half step between the NES game and the WayForward game. They were like, hey, what if these weren't like horrible little stick men and the blob didn't have this grotesque face on its body? And they made it cute, but otherwise it's exactly the same. But I do like the puzzle solving element, you know, like you create a hole with the blob. So you're basically using a creature to become nothing. It's very Bugs Bunny. and you fall through the hole. And, you know, if you fall in the right places, it will take you to places you need to be. This is kind of the first puzzle in the game, really, is that you have to create a hole in the floor, but you have to do it in the right place, because if you do it from too, you know, in the wrong spot, you'll fall too far. And boy, is not Pitfall Harry. He will die if he falls from too high. So you have to kind of figure out, like, oh, this was the right thing to do, but the wrong place to do it. And then there's weird little monsters that kind of have the same color scheme and aesthetic as the blob, and they'll jump around and crawl around, and you have to avoid them. And you can't really hurt them or destroy them. So it becomes about evasion. It becomes about figuring out how to keep the blob with you throughout the game as you explore into new places. And there are, you know, again, that's one of those puns. There is a ketchup flavored jelly bean, and if you toss it, the blob will automatically come to wherever you are because it's catching up with you. And it's, you know, just a little bit of a groaner. It's some real dad humor. I assume David Crane had kids by this point, so that explains a lot. But you know, puns. He does. No, it's witty and it's fun, and you know, it really builds on a lot of the concepts in Pitfall 2 to make them more of a structured environmental puzzle, which is really great. But it's, like I said, it's a pretty slight game once you figure it all out. And it's very, it feels very much like an anti-rental game in that it's really, really punishing and really, really kind of arbitrary at times.
I like that if you trick the blob into eating a ketchup jelly bean, he turns into a useless brick wall. I thought that was really, really funny as a kid.
So, Stuart, you mentioned that you had played this recently. Any other thoughts on it?
No, only what I've said already. I do enjoy the sort of cruelty of it. I enjoy the sort of exploration factor of everything you do is just like, will this help me? Will this move me forward? Or is it just a wasted jelly bean? The new release doesn't even have like, well, I mean, I think you can look at the manual, but that's it. And you'd expect there to be some kind of map or something, but maybe there is. I don't know. I liked it. I can see why people wouldn't like it, but I liked it a lot. It seems quite a difficult, challenging game, but not just in the sense that it's hard, in the sense that it's really like out there. There's nothing else much like it in terms of design, and you know that makes it interesting to me. Maybe not one I would play without a guide these days, though.
Supposedly, Miyamoto liked the game when they showed it to him. So,
okay. Interesting.
Well, there's no accounting for taste.
So they did follow this up with a Game Boy game called The Rescue of Princess Blobette, which is an even slighter game. Like, there's really not that much to it, and it starts out with, like, super arbitrary puzzles. It's kind of weirdly skewed. It almost feels like an expert version of A Boy and His Blob, but at the same time, there's not as much to it. So it's kind of strange. It's a weird little game, but it... It takes place entirely inside of a castle, and it's much less of, you know, in A Boy and His Blob, you start at the top left and kind of move down, you know, move to the right, then down into the underground, and then you kind of work your way back around to where you started, because that's where the vitamin stuff that you need, like the ability to buy vitamins, is in a bag. And your extra jelly beans, it'll turn you into a rocket to let you fly to the other planet. And then you use the jack to open up the manhole that's right by the starting point, which is kind of cool. And then, you know, from there you go onto the blob planet. But this one, you kind of start in the middle of the castle, and there's turrets above you and towers and dungeons below. And it's not a very big game, but it's also really, really hard. And, you know, the smaller screen dimensions of the Game Boy mean that you have less pixel information. So it's much harder to kind of work your way around without dying a lot and, you know, accidentally falling too far and that sort of thing. So it's challenging, but not necessarily for all the right reasons.
I got this quite recently, like a cartridge of it, and... it starts in the same way as like the Dizzy games, where you're just locked into a room and you have to figure out how to get out. And once you do that, you're in sort of the open map. But immediately it feels like you've broken the game. You've gone out of the bounds because you're in these big voids, like completely empty screens. And you're like, what the hell is going on?
So you have to keep jumping on the trampoline until you get the diamonds that are hidden way above.
God, I didn't. Even more esoteric than the NES game. And there's, you know, that makes it have some appeal, but I don't want to actually play it, you know?
I love that about you. When I explain some horrible arbitrary mechanic that's punishing and unfair and unintuitive, you're like, oh, that's great, but I still don't want to play.
It would compel me. Things like that are just compelling. I like it when there's
The developer doesn't like me personally. That's cool.
Yeah. The personal touch, you know, polishes the enemy of creativity.
Yeah, I've never played this Game Boy one, but as a kid, I remember reading it about it in Nintendo Power, thinking, wow, that looks really cool. I want to check that out. And I never have, and I should probably get on that at some point.
Yeah, give it a go.
Alright, well, my blood oxygen saturation is really, really low now, so I think we need to wrap this up so I can go take a breath. But yeah, anyway, that's the David Crane phase of the Pitfall series, and it's a little blobby side story. Good games, lots of innovation. I feel like The Rescue of Princess Blobette is kind of a weird way to end, but, you know, David Crane did other stuff like Ghostbusters and I don't know, some other stuff. So, you know, it's not like that's his only legacy.
He did Amazing Tennis.
Yeah.
No, was it amazing? That's the real question.
I've heard it's pretty good. You know, he is a tennis player, so he probably knows his stuff there.
There you go. So anyway, having spoken now about the David Crane Pitfall games, we will reconvene at some point in the near future to talk about the games created beyond David Crane's tenure with Pitfall and with Activision, including some bad ones, but also some good ones. But we're gonna start next episode with a rip roaring beginning with Super Pitfall, which is just an absolute delight. That Stuart, that's got to be one of your favorites. Is my
guess. Played through the whole of Super Pitfall recently.
Holy
and why
the
words.
Whole thing
with a guide. Obviously, I'm not insane.
No, but still.
Yeah, I had to know what it was like, and I was actually taken aback multiple times at just how esoteric and difficult and unfair it was.
It's a wild game. I'm actually looking forward to talking about it. I expected. It's worse and better in so many ways.
I got to say this. I just looked this up real quick. I looked David Crane up, and he programmed Bart versus the Space Mutants, and that explains everything about that game. Like, now that I know that he did that, I'm just like, okay, because I love that game, and it sucks, and I love it.
Well, there you go. Sucks, but I love it. That's
David Crane. Thank you, David, for all your terrible, awesome games. Like, seriously, they're absolutely awesome.
No, I mean, some of the games he made are genuinely good. I mean, we just talked about Pitfall and Pitfall 2, and I really can't criticize those games. They're awesome. They're great, especially for the time.
I think that Space Mutants is genuinely good. I think people just don't get it. I will nothing but praise for the man.
I mean, I just went to the mats defending Friday the 13th, which I don't actually like for NES. But that is also a game that people genuinely did not get. You know, very much, we were talking earlier about Raiders of the Lost Ark for Atari 2600, E.T. Like, those are all of a piece. So there is something about this, like, this fascinating subset of video games developed by incredibly intelligent programmers who want you to think like them and don't really care about accommodating you. And once you think like them, once you kind of see the direction they're approaching things, you're like, oh, I get it. This is interesting. But until that point, you're just like, what is this garbage and why should I keep playing? Anyway, that doesn't really have anything to do with the original
the
Pitfall.
It's the glorious time before the rules of how you make and how you like present a video game hadn't yet been codified, and you could go in and make something unique and interesting and singular. And that was good. You know, it wasn't a bad thing like people say it is now. It was good.
Well, I think the original Pitfall actually, as I think about it, kind of embodies like when that developer, that genius programmer mindset, like, think my way works well, because Pitfall works as fun if you just play it as a platformer without understanding the goals. But like I said earlier, once you start to kind of decrypt it and figure out how things work together, then you kind of like do the galaxy brain thing. You're like, oh, now I can really beat this. But even if you don't get that, it's still really fun, like you said, to play for 20 minutes and see how many treasures you can get, what your score can be.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's probably a great testament to Pitfall, is just like, that's its place in video game history. It's a genius game for stupid people.
and a lot of other games sort of aped it in the years afterwards. You know, Coleco had the Smurfs game and the Cabbage Patch Kids game, and those were both...
There's Pac-Land,
which
also, you know, just like Pitfall 2, it drew from a bad American cartoon for inspiration.
Pac-Land's awesome.
Yeah, there's a Japanese video game book from 1988 that has, like... this whole chart of the lineage of different types of games and genres. And it does have Pitfall leading directly into Pac-Land for some reason. So
nice.
What they know that I don't, I really want to dig into.
All right. Well, I, in my opinion, feel like that wraps it up for Retronauts episode 574. And this is a patron exclusive episode. So I don't need to tell you kids once again, how you can support Retronauts, because you already do, and we love you for that, and that is why we are talking about Pitfall and A Boy and His Blob, because we know you love that. So, thank you for joining our mutual love fest. Stuart, where can we find you and your work on the internet?
You can find me on Retronauts, of course. I've put a book out called All Games Are Good, and that's available from Limited Run and on Amazon for the paperback, though it seems to be sold out, which is intimidating. I don't know what the allocation was, but I hope it was enormous, and hopefully it'll be back in stock again soon. It's all about me sort of doing this and talking about all of the sort of the weirdo old games that I like that no one else does for 400 pages. So yeah, get it. It's very, very good. You'll enjoy it. Also, I'm working on this project called Ninsight, which is a Nintendo sort of journal thing, and I'm editing all the retro content for that, so there's some really good, interesting kind of emotional writing in there, so I advise you to have a look at it. Ninsight. Good name, right?
Ninsight, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Kevin, how about you?
You can find me on the internet at Ubersaurus on... mostly Blue Sky nowadays. I guess I still have a Twitter account. I have a book that's also out through Limited Run Games and on Amazon called Atari Archive. If you want to learn more about Atari in the early years and various other aspects of the home game industry, that's your book right there. I have an Atari Archive YouTube series where I'm currently going through 1982, and in the coming months we'll be talking about Pitfall in more detail.
Hell yeah, synergy.
Yeah, synergy.
Yeah, so as for myself, basically I'm just imitating Kevin in everything I do. I've got a book from Limited Run Games that you can read. I've got a YouTube series about video game console chronologies. I have no original thoughts in my brain, but that's okay because I can talk about video games and that requires no originality because all of them are clones now. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll be back, on Monday with a full proper episode, which is not one that I've hosted, but it's still proper regardless. It looks like it's a Stuart episode, so...
Oh, boy.
semi-proper.
That's the guy who I am.
That's you. So, pressure's on, Stuart.
All right.
You better live up to expectations. And we'll be back again sometime soon to talk more about the latter-day Pitfall games beyond... not just beyond the jungle, but beyond the crane.
Whoa.